Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a new pre-publication review policy issued by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence that bars officials in all 17 intelligence agencies from speaking without permission to journalists about unclassified information related to intelligence at the risk of civil penalties and the loss of security clearances and access. Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, joins us to discuss renewed efforts to censor even unclassified government information and cut off access to the press, as well as Scott Horton's latest article at Harper's that blows holes in the government's claims about the deaths of three prisoners at Guantanamo, the Guantanamo suicides, in quote, a Camp Delta sergeant blows the whistle. Then we'll examine the likely foreign policy impact of a new and more assertive nationalist leader in India, Narendra Modi, and speak with Ashley Tellis, who served as a senior advisor to the ambassador at the United States Embassy in New Delhi and on the National Security Council staff as special assistant to the president and senior director for strategic planning and Southwest Asia. We will discuss the strategic implications towards China of Modi's close personal ties to Japan's nationalist leader Shinzo Abe and the complications of a more assertive policy towards Pakistan. Then finally, we will get a more personal analysis of the man who is India's new prime minister and examine Modi's Hindu fundamentalist roots and the legal implications of his cover-up of a previous marriage with a child of his. Dr. Abusalah Sharif, the executive director and chief scholar at the U.S.-India Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., who is engaged in policy research that impacts both the U.S. and the Indian governments, joins us to discuss a leader who may be more cynical than pious, who uses religion as a divisive political tool without taking responsibility for the sectarian violence that often ensues religious incitement. And joining us now is Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, and serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. And his latest article at Harper's is The Guantanamo Suicides, in quote, a Camp Delta sergeant blows the whistle. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Ian, great to be with you.
And what's happening now with the intelligence community, particularly the General Clapper, the head of the Office of, he's the Director of National Intelligence, and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence has just issued these new guidelines for intelligence personnel in terms of how they deal with journalists. And this covers current and former employees and contractors of all the 17 intelligence agencies that may not cite news reports based on leaks in their speeches, opinion articles, books, term papers, or other unofficial writings. This seems like an extraordinary form of censorship, particularly when it relates to unclassified information.
Well, that's exactly right. I like to refer to this as the Clapper Fatwa, because that's what it is. It's a declaration of war on whistleblowers, but also a declaration of war on democracy and democratic institutions. And I think the pushback we hear from the agency right now is, well, this is really nothing new. All these rules have always been there before. But here they're being codified and presented in a far more aggressive posture than we've ever seen them before. And I think by way of background, we have to start by reminding ourselves that that General Clapper is the man who came before Congress and lied point blank about the nature of NSA proceedings. And his lies were revealed, and he was horribly embarrassed as a result of a whistleblower action, largely the Snowden disclosures, which made completely clear that he was making false statements. And so that was intensely embarrassing to him. And indeed, I think, no less than George Shultz, former Secretary of State, said said recently he didn't understand how Clapper was still serving in the government after that, because certainly it is a very, very serious crime to lie to Congress, which is what he did, but he hasn't been prosecuted. Instead, he's trying to turn his guns very aggressively on the people who embarrassed him.
But this is serious, though, for people inside the government who can't even comment on unclassified news reports, because failure to comply with Clapper's instructions will result in the imposition of civil and administrative penalties and may result in the loss of security clearances and access. And if you're in the intelligence business and you lose your security clearance, you're as good as dead.
That's exactly right. And the penalties would also include forfeiture of benefits and pension rights and everything else. So it's quite severe. And I think here, you just look at it practically. Let's say you are you're an intelligence officer. You went to college with someone who went on to be a writer or editor for a publication somewhere. You can't go have lunch with your college friend without getting pre-clearance from the intelligence service. Now, that's what they're saying. So they're imposing an incredible chill on all dealings with journalists, and the definition of journalists is also extremely expansive. And this would also apply even to people who are no longer actively in government employ. Let's say someone who retired and has now become a college professor or a writer or a movie consultant. With respect to things within their knowledge from the time of their service, they would be subject to the same sorts of restrictions.
Well, but people like you and me, Scott, are pretty much put out of business, aren't we? I mean, isn't that aren't we the collateral damage, or perhaps the intention of this new rule that journalists who are interested in national security affairs, I'm interested in, because I think that's where you learn the most, right? The secrets.
That's exactly right. I think this, if we look back over the last 3 or 4 years to this really aggressive clampdown on whistleblowers, the targets consistently have been reporters and writers on national security issues. So the government goes through, checks pen numbers, and they're eager to see when has someone with access to classified information spoken to a journalist or writer. That's what they're after. And this is just ratcheting up the pressure to another level. And this is at a time when we've got more than 1 million people in the United States who are subject potentially to these restrictions. And we have more and more vital information relating to the waging of wars overseas and diplomatic matters is classified. We have more classified information than ever before, and it is increasingly difficult for the public to learn about what its government is doing. So there are all sorts of things which routinely would have been the subject of reports by the press and the media in the past, which the government is increasingly putting out of the reach of the public. So this is part of an effort to ensure that the voters in a democratic society do not know what their government is doing.
Again, I'm speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, and serves on the American branch of the International Law Association, and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers, and has a new article at Harper's, "The Guantanamo Suicides," in quote, "A Camp Delta Sergeant Blows the Whistle." So, is there an explanation for this in kind of personal terms, Scott, that Clapper, who you pointed out lied under oath to the Congress and to the American people about PRISM and the early information that Snowden put out, or actually was embarrassed by the early information that Snowden put out? My understanding is that the Snowden damage to national security is incredible. I mean, they're all reeling from it. They don't know exactly how much he's gotten, but they basically figure that that he's essentially been working for the Russians all along, at getting being able to cherry pick all this important information and get it out in a way that makes it look like he's a he's a hero because people like Glenn Greenwald and others are essentially perhaps unwitting covers for his what they call an exfiltration to Russia, where they finally called him back with this amazing treasure trove. And already you've got people like Secretary of State Kerry saying privately that he was completely blindsided by Putin's grab of Crimea because the Russians went dark. There was no intelligence of what they were up to, which they attributed to the Snowden leaks. So if the reports that I'm hearing from the intelligence community that Snowden is responsible for the greatest blow to American intelligence in history, maybe there's a hyperbole there. They always exaggerate. But on the other hand, is that mean that everybody else is being a scapegoat, that they're all kind of flaying around in anger and, you know, beating up on the wrong people?
Yes, it means they're beating up on the wrong people. I would say, first of all, there is no participant in this public discussion as guilty of hyperbole as the intelligence services. They scream bloody murder and say that the sky is falling in every time there's a significant leak. Remember when the Bradley Manning leaks occurred, we were told that American uniformed personnel would die as a result of this, that there would be horrible damage to U.S. diplomacy around the world. I spent some time with the BBC reviewing these claims, and we were very hard-pressed to find any credible evidence of damage. We found a lot of evidence of positive things coming out of it for the United States. But I think with the Snowden disclosures, there's no doubt that disclosures of means and methods of signals intelligence gathering has been harmful to the United States. But I'd say most of the harm has come in embarrassment concerning policy decisions and policy choices the government has made that it is not able to publicly justify. So the U.S. lied to the American people, lied to its allies about what it was doing. And when these things were disclosed, the U.S. really wasn't in a position to plausibly justify what it was doing. So I'd say those are the big things. Now, that's harmful, but that's not a bad kind of harm. That's the sort of dialogue we should have in a democratic society. Vis-a-vis what's happened with Russia and being blindsided by Putin and so on, I would really doubt that Snowden's disclosures really harmed that. That issue. In fact, I think our satellite intelligence of what Putin has been doing and what he's been up to and our signals intercepts, all that's fine. And I think we're in a good position there. I think the U.S. has made a decision that it's not going to involve itself militarily in Crimea, which is or in eastern Ukraine, which is the reason that that's going on. But I think these issues, I think the main questions really have to do with to what extent we're going to have an educated public about critical questions of national security, and particularly about questions that relate directly to going to war or making peace.
Well, but if any of these claims by the intelligence community about the damage that Snowden is alleged to have done, if any of them are true, it's all on them. It's about the fact that they hire people to screen people's background clearances through these private contractors who pay minimum wage workers, that they weren't watching the store. This is not the fault of journalists or people like you and me. It's their problem.
That's exactly right. I mean, in fact, I'd say we have that issue both with Bradley Manning and Edward Snowden. That is, you know, we have these two mega leaks that have occurred in massive quantity. And the big question people should be asking right up front is why Bradley Manning and why Edward Snowden had access to all of this information. We really haven't gotten plausible explanations out of the NSA or previously from the military of why that was so. I mean, it's obviously gross errors. I think it's to say that it's the media that's responsible for that or journalists doing their job is not really a responsible criticism.
So let's turn to your most recent article. It's at Harper's Now, Scott Horton, the Guantanamo suicides and, quote, a Camp Delta sergeant blows the whistle. I take it that you're blowing a hole here, your article's blowing a hole in the government's claim about the death of three prisoners at Guantanamo. I think it was, back in 2006?
Yeah, it was in June 9, 2006 that this originally occurred, and I published an article about this about 3 years ago, which reviewed all the government's claims and pointed to all the problems with it. Now we've discovered a set of about 12 documents, one of which we published in Harper's yesterday, that are from the government's own internal investigation, which they had suppressed originally, and we have now pulled out. And these documents, again, show that the government's claims that these three people committed suicide in their cell are almost certainly not true. And instead, it appears that these three prisoners have been extracted from their cells that evening and taken to a facility which the perimeter guards called Camp No. We now know through work of the Associated Press that this facility was referred to by the CIA as Penny Lane. And we also know at that time that it was an active site that was used in connection with the PSYOPs operation to try and turn prisoners. So this is when the Bush administration was starting to release people from Guantanamo. And as is usual in such circumstances, the intelligence service was trying to win some of them over and turn them into intelligence assets. I think the U.S. has had a real problem all along with al-Qaeda in terms of not having really very good human intelligence within the organization. So this was an effort to plant people inside who could give reports. And these three people were clearly caught up in that program, and they were subjected to something that resulted in their death that evening. And the government, rather than come clean and explain everything that was going on, has created this fable, basically, about them committing suicides in their cells as a cover story.
Well, but what happened to those people? The weird reports of orange blood. I mean, what was going on? Do you know?
Yeah, I mean, of course, we still don't have details. What we know is that all three of them had a piece of cloth, like an athletic sock, stuffed down their throats. And there was a study done by the University of California at Davis looking at this pattern. And it was found to be similar to something that was going on around the same time at the naval brig in Charleston, a procedure that was called dry boarding. So it was a procedure designed to induce a sensation of asphyxiation. So in essence, almost exactly the same thing as waterboarding, but without the water. And in the, I guess, the most plausible scenario, well, we know, first of all, these three people all died as a result of having this cloth stuffed down their throats. So there was probably a misadministration of this technique, and it resulted in death. So I think it's rather unlikely that these were intentional homicides, but it does seem to be directly connected to this intelligence service program.
Well, Scott Horton, your article is available there at Harper's for all to see, a Guantanamo suicide in quote, a Camp Delta sergeant blows a whistle. And I thank you very much for joining us.
Great to be with you, Ian. Good luck.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, and serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into a more assertive foreign policy from India's new nationalist leader.
I'm looking for a sign. I'm looking for the treason that I knew in 65. Beware the South is yours. Oh, 1984. See, come see, remember me.
Yeah, you got it on my movie roll. You said it would last, but I guess we enrolled in 1984. Welcome
back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ashley Tellis, who's a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, specializing in international security, defense, and Asian strategic issues. He was a senior advisor to the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs at the State Department, where he was intimately involved in negotiating the civil nuclear agreement with India. Previously, he served as senior advisor to the ambassador at the United States Embassy in New Delhi and on the National Security Council staff as special assistant to the president and senior director for strategic planning and Southwest Asia. He is the author of India's Emerging Nuclear Posture and co-author of Interpreting China's Grand Strategy, Past, Present, and Future. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ashley Tellis.
Thank you, Ian. It's great to be back.
It's good to talk to you again, Ashley. And the president did have a phone conversation with the new Prime Minister, Narendra Modi of India, who has a stunning victory, even though it's only 30% of the vote. We should keep that in context. But, of course, technically, at the time that his victory happened, Modi was still banned from getting a visa to the United States. Clearly, the phone conversation where the president invited him to come to the United States at a mutually agreeable time trumps that. But it is a little strange and perhaps even embarrassing.
It is an awkward moment for both countries because the circumstances, of course, that led up to the U.S. government revoking that visa in 2005 are now well known. They have to do with accusations about Modi's inaction during the riots that took place in Gujarat in 2002. But the fact of the matter is, at the end of the day, the United States and India have converging interests. And Mr. Modi, for all his personal grievances against the United States, is a committed Indian nationalist who I think will take his bearings from what India requires of the U.S. in the years to come. And so I think we can actually have a productive working relationship even if he continues to nurse some grievances for a while longer.
But isn't there a fairly stark contrast between these two leaders, Obama and Modi? Obama, of course, comes out of an American liberal inclusive tradition, and Modi seems to be a rather plain-spoken nationalist, opposed to welfare and to appeasement of minorities. In other words, the nationalist versus the politically correct leader.
That is true. I mean, the differences between the two are actually quite clear and quite conspicuous. President Obama is also a deeply cerebral individual. Prime Minister-elect Modi is not. He's a man of very strong convictions, but not given to sophisticated and elaborate reasoning, at least in public. But I think at the end of the day, a certain pragmatism will come to dominate his regime in India. He recognizes the point that you made earlier on, which is he has a landslide victory in terms of the number of seats in parliament, but he has not crossed the threshold where the popular vote is concerned. And by the way, that has been true for every government in India since independence. No government has ever had a majority of the popular vote. So in that sense, he is not unique. But even so, I think he recognizes the limits of his mandate, and he has said publicly that he wants to be an inclusive prime minister representing the interests of all Indians. And I think he will actually do that because whatever else he does, he is a politician. He wants to stay in power for a long time. And he knows that the only way to making that happen is to be successful. And he cannot be successful politically if he pursues a divisive social policy.
But in terms of foreign policy, Ashley Tellis, there's an expectation that he's likely to have a more assertive foreign policy. And to my mind, I think it's very telling that one of the first people to send congratulations to India's new prime minister is the new nationalist leader of Japan, Abe, who in many ways seem to be similar, and I think a real alliance is going to develop, is it not, between India and Japan?
I think that is true. Remember, Shinzo Abe was one of the few foreign leaders who actually developed a personal relationship with Narendra Modi when he was in the wilderness. They met on several occasions, and Abe was very taken
by Modi. And so I expect that simply as a matter of personal relationship as well as national strategy, Japan and India will come much closer in years to come than they've ever been in the past. But I want to address the issue of assertiveness. In some ways, an assertive Indian foreign policy may not be a bad thing, depending on what its assertiveness entails. I mean, for the last 5 years, for example, we've seen an Indian foreign policy that has been, you know, terribly rudderless and lacking direction. So if assertiveness means that we will understand clearly what the intentions of India's leadership are, then that's a good thing. If assertiveness means picking fights with India's neighbors, then that's obviously not good for us and certainly not good for India. My own sense is that Modi will be careful about how he deals with India's neighbors because of the issues of his own personal reputation. And again, because I think fights with India's neighbors distract from what he sees as his legacy issue, which is setting right the economy, going back to the phase of high growth, and in the process, you know, being seen as successful by the Indian electorate.
But on in terms of what's been happening on the American side of the U.S.-India relations, it does feel that the President Obama somewhat dropped the ball. There's no question that President Clinton was deeply engaged and was very fond of India. And I happen to know I.K. Gujral, the Prime Minister, and they had a very good relationship. And then also the Bush administration kept a vigorous engagement going. It seems like it's lapsed under Obama. Is that your impression?
I think it has in some ways. The president has certainly been distracted by a succession of crises that he's had to deal with since he took office. He, of course, had a very successful visit to India, and he actually moved the ball further. You know, he announced, despite, you know, great skepticism that he would, the U.S. support for India's candidacy to the U.N. Security Council. He completed, actually, the civil nuclear cooperation accord that was begun by his predecessor, you know, President Bush. But in recent years, and certainly in the second term, he has not paid as much personal attention to India. And it's also suffered, the relationship has also suffered because of the fact of Hillary Clinton's departure. When Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, she focused on India a great deal, in part because of her own husband's interest and her personal interest in India. I think we can put some of the pieces back together if Mr. Modi, you know, takes, you know, responds to the overtures that the president has now made, because there is a lot that can be productively done in the next 2 years of, you know, the Obama administration's life. And certainly my advice to, you know, Mr. Modi and the people around him would be, you know, take the opportunity for everything it's worth. The U.S. has a lot to offer, but, you know, I think India has to at least take one step forward.
So, but in terms of the broader geopolitical landscape, with the idea that India could be some kind of buffer against China's growing hegemony in the neighborhood, if not the world, you know, there's obviously a lot of backlash over what is often referred to as piles of rocks in the South China Sea, with both South Korea, Japan, now very intense clashes with Vietnam and Chinese factories being burnt in Vietnam, very tense relations with the Philippines. And the idea that the new Indian Prime Minister and the Japanese Prime Minister see eye to eye, you can't escape the idea that maybe there's a deal in the works, that Japan will invest deeply in India's infrastructure, which is in desperate need of being brought up to date. And also, there'll be some kind of, do you think there'll be some kind of military alignment?
I'm not certain of that. In fact, I'm skeptical that you will see a military alignment between Japan and India. What is likely to happen is that India is going to remain more actively engaged in East and Southeast Asia. I think that is inevitable. Mr. Modi sees that as a priority for India. He sees the need to rejuvenate what used to be called the Look East policy. And he will certainly create more opportunities for investment from East Asia and Southeast Asia in India. So there will certainly be a tightening of India's relations with these two important quadrants of the world. But I think India still recognizes that it is a weak state. It does not have the power projection capabilities that could make a difference to the East Asian balance of power. And India has still got unresolved security problems in its own neighborhood, both with Pakistan and with China. And so to the degree that India can be a balancer, I think the balancing will take the form of India becoming a more capable country that provides China some reason for pause. But I don't think India is going to go beyond that in terms of creating active security agreements or active security alliances that require it to bring its power to bear in East and Southeast Asia. I think that is still a bridge too far.
But in terms of China's relationship with Pakistan, there is, of course, that in itself was generated out of a geopolitical clash with India, was it not?
That is absolutely true. But you've seen in the last two decades an interesting turn of events. The Chinese-Pakistan relationship has by no means diminished. But the Sino-Indian relationship, especially in the economic arena, has really grown gangbusters. And so what you find is that the Indians now face the same dilemma with China that the United States has. They are deeply concerned about the rise of Chinese power. They are actually threatened by the rise of Chinese power. But they are also economically intertwined with China in ways that are extremely significant. Today, China is India's largest merchandise trading partner. And so that automatically imposes some limits on the kinds of strategies that India can pursue. It no longer has the luxury of a pure balancing strategy against China. It has to couple the balancing, which it will certainly indulge in, with some degree of engagement. And from a Chinese point of view, I think the same is true as well. India, for them, is a place where they make a lot of money. And so they have to make a judgment about how far they're going to go in support of Pakistan, while holding at risk what is an economically lucrative relationship with New Delhi.
But clearly things are likely to get more tense in Pakistan with the withdrawal of the US, and Pakistan has put itself in a dilemma in as much as it has basically created the Taliban. And now if the Taliban is unleashed and takes over, or there's a civil war and a bloody stalemate, Pakistan itself is in danger of reverse sanctuary, where the Taliban, in effect, use Afghanistan as a sanctuary, and then in order to attack Pakistan. So they've sort of, to some extent, that government's reaping the whirlwind. At least the military and the ISI are reaping the whirlwind of their strategy throughout this whole agonizing American experience in Afghanistan. That is certainly not going to end with a stable Afghanistan.
I think you are absolutely correct. And from a Pakistani point of view, it must be, you know, terribly ironic that their success, or at least the strategy that they pursued, which was to make the life of the United States somewhat difficult in the last 15-odd years, has now come to fruition in the worst possible way. They've got the United States out of Afghanistan, which was, you know, their strategic objective early on. And now they find themselves in a position where the forces that they've unleashed are essentially the same forces that threaten them. Unfortunately, this is not something that China can help resolve. Pakistan has to make some strategic decisions about its own national trajectory. And thus far, unfortunately, the decisions it has made are, you know, still very, very compromised and very, very diffident.
But we know that this government and the military in Pakistan are very paranoid about India's intentions in Afghanistan, and they've overblown them. So if you have a more assertive, even aggressive Indian prime minister and a more paranoid India, who already convinced that India is playing games inside of Afghanistan, isn't that a recipe for, if not disaster, more tension?
It would be. If the scenario unfolds in exactly the way you described, that to me is essentially the worst case scenario that one can imagine. And in those circumstances, of course, we would see a very poisoned India-Pakistan relationship beyond what it already is. And, you know, some probability that the two countries would actually come to blows in different ways, whether it be in Afghanistan or bilaterally between themselves. But I think the near-term scenario is somewhat different. The near-term scenario, at least for the next year where Mr. Modi is concerned, my sense is that the policy he will adopt is essentially one of strategic indifference, where until he is convinced that Pakistan is willing to deal with those terrorist groups that directly threaten India, and here groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba come to mind, he will not make extraordinary efforts to reach out to Pakistan. And of course, that creates different kinds of problems, because a Pakistan that feels ignored, a Pakistan that feels that, you know, it's at the receiving end of Indian indifference, can choose to do crazy things to get New Delhi's attention. And that is something that, of course, we have to be alert to. But I think that is the real fear, at least in the near term. And what happens, of course, post-2014 is anyone's guess at this point. But the scenario that you laid out is one that all parties have to think very seriously about.
But just in closing, if Modi, his nationalist instincts create a disquiet, a nervousness amongst India's large Muslim minority, any incidents in that neighborhood would affect the relationship with Pakistan, because, you know, what people forget is that India's Muslim minority are very loyal to India, but if they have a prime minister who is hostile to them, perhaps that could change that equation.
And I think that is right as well, which is why the biggest unfinished business coming out of this election for him has to be proving that he is going to be inclusive in his policies and that he is genuinely going to represent the interests of all India's diverse peoples and not simply that section of the electorate that that brought him into power. That is really his unfinished business. And, you know, we will have to see in the next few months how he proceeds to address this.
Well, Ashley Tellis, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Ashley Tellis, who is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, specializing in international security, defense, and Asian strategic issues. He was a senior advisor to the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs at the State Department, where he was intimately involved in negotiating the civil nuclear agreement with India. Previously, he served as senior advisor to the ambassador at the United States Embassy in New Delhi and on the National Security Council staff as special assistant to the president and senior director for strategic planning and Southwest Asia. He's the author of India's Emerging Nuclear Posture and co-author of Interpreting China's Grand Strategy, Past, Present, and Future. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the man who is India's new prime minister. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Abusalah Sharif, who is the Executive Director and Chief Scholar at the U.S.-India Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., where he's engaged in policy research that impacts both the U.S. and Indian governments. He has been a Chief Economist at the National Council of Applied Economic Research in New Delhi and was a member of the Ministry of Home Affairs in the Government of India and was an advisor to the Indian Prime Minister from 2004 to 2006, reviewing the inclusive growth policies in the context of Muslims, the largest of India's minorities. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Abusalah Sharif.
Thank you, Ian.
So this new leader of India, who, by the way, was still technically banned from coming to the United States, and the ban was still in place on the day of his victory. There's a great fear amongst some people in both in India and abroad that think because Modi was a supporter of the right-wing pro-Hindu social movement, the RSS, that there will be signs that his government could be much less tolerant of criticism, hostile towards press freedom, and polarize the country along religious lines. Do you expect that to happen?
Yes, the history of India's independence is full with the recorded events where right-wing Hindu political parties, right-wing Hindu ideology has been taking firm roots as we move forward. We are 67th year after independence, and the BJP as a party has already ruled twice. At least once it had a full term. So the BJP rule is not new to India. Even the minorities, including the Muslims and the so-called secularists and intellectuals, they are used to living in an environment where BJP has already made policies. Narendra Modi was an RSS, Rashtriya Swayam Sevak. This is a social group. It is pan-Indian. It exists all over India, but mostly governed by high caste communities. High caste. India, the caste system is very deep in India, so it is regulated or it is managed by the high caste groups. But this is the first time that an OBC, a non-high caste person, that is Modi, has taken the reign of the BJP as the prime minister. That may be one of the reasons why he got support from a large number of people, because he doesn't belong to a high caste community. However, Modi himself has a bit strenuous relationships with the RSS. Generally, Modi tend to suggest that when the communal riots took place in Gujarat in 2002, although he was the chief minister, the whole killing and the carnage was done by the RSS and other ultra-extreme groups like Vishwa Hindu Parishad and Bajrang Dal. And also, in spite of the fact that he was constitutional authority, he should have taken actions to stop massacre. The Indian courts somehow, for unknown reasons, are unable to make him responsible. This gives the impression that the Indian judiciary is not free from political influences, or even to a certain degree, the ideological influences. So India is, in that sense, a melting pot of different ideas. India is an emerging, not only an economy, but also it is maturing. Its democracy is maturing slowly. But the unfortunate thing is that in democracy, it is the majority who rules. But unlike in United States, where the majority is closer to 50%, in India, it has never been 50% ruling the country. It has always been around 30%. For example, this time BJP got about 30% of the votes. So 61%, actually, to be precise, electorate did not vote for BJP or Modi. So in that sense, it is not a majority government. In fact, it is a government of the minority people. The reason is that one of the defects of Indian democracy is that there are hundreds and thousands of registered political parties. For example, it is possible that there are 200 people contesting for the same member of parliament position for Lok Sabha, the lower house. And given that situation, a person who can take as little as 20% of the votes, sometimes even less, can win the elections.
So tell me.
I hope you understand.
Yeah, no, I do.
You understood the situation.
I do understand the situation, and it is surprising because all of the press reports are talking about an electoral triumph, and congratulations are coming in from around the world. But as you point out, Modi's stunning victory still only represents 30% of the country, which is definitely a paradox. But let's try and talk about who this man is, Dr. Abdullah Sharif. Is he the fact that he, as a young man, was married and had a child, but denied that for the rest of his life, and then lived a celibate life in accordance with, with the Hindu religion in its more fundamentalist form, I imagine, right?
Yes. Yes. In Indian politics, unlike in the United States, we have the recorded example of President Clinton here, you know, how the personal life becomes so important in politics. But somehow in India, some of the so-called personal traits or personal attributes are not generally used in political decision-making. But what Narendra Modi's personality suggests is that he has now a kind of absolute power because of the majority. The BJP party alone has more than 272 seats. There is a possibility of an authoritarian decision-making. And actually, people craved for such kind of decision-making, although that is not the best way for an analyst like me and others. That's not how India's decision-making should be done. It has to be done through consultative process. It has to be done by taking opposition views into account. And that is how our decisions should be made in democracy. But somehow our electorate tend to think that the previous prime minister was weak, although I think in my view, one of the best prime ministers India has ever seen was Dr. Manmohan Singh. Because during his tenure as prime ministership, India has seen best of the economic growth, and India has seen fairly good, peace and harmony and relationships with neighboring countries, and also balancing relationship with superpowers, the so-called like United States and Europe and Russia. I'm now China. So those balancing acts were done substantially fairly well during Manmohan Singh period. But now we believe that some of the decisions which Modi may take could be autocratic, could be knee-jerk reaction to a few things. So there is a possibility of some sort of nuclear decisions like the Vajpayee regime took, if you recollect when Vajpayee became the prime minister, the BJP party, and then there was a nuclear blast in India. So there is an expectation that something of similar nature may happen. To just make an announcement that the power is with this person and the power is with the BJP, which is a nationalist party. It is a kind of non-secular party. It is a party which doesn't recognize recognize the human rights of the minorities, particularly the religious minorities.
But in the fact that Mr. Modi, the first thing he did after being elected was to go to Varanasi, the holiest city, where he went to the Lord Shiva's temple. So how much of a religious fundamentalist is he, given that he was apparently embarrassed by the fact that he was married and had a secret child and that he has lived a celibate life? What is give me a sense in Hindu religion how that would relate, say, in the American political context? Who would be that religious in America's political context?
Well, from the point of view of the Indian, the electorate will not bother much whether he had a wife or not at the moment. The charisma and of Modi alone is hanging on, but judiciary could have taken a role, because in his first he contested from two seats. From the first seat, Vadodara, when he declared under oath, you need to declare before you become a candidate. He did not declare that he was married, but that declaration took place when he was filing his application from Varanasi, the second constituency. So obviously there are lies and truths. So judiciary and the election commission by now should have taken some decisions about it, and they have obviously ignored, and they allowed him to contest and win both these elections, although the declaration was untruthful. So this is the point which I'm making. In India, we still have our democracy, still our democratic institutions, our judicial institutions, our bureaucracy and bureaucratic institutions are still not matured enough. Still, we have not put the rules of the game in their, in the best form.
But in terms of him being religious and the extent to which he is a religious fundamentalist, could you compare him to anybody that we would recognize in the American political landscape?
Well, that
like,
is...
Like the Reverend Pat Robinson, for example.
Right. Well, because I'm a bit new to United States history of government, so I presume that you may have some people of that nature. But in the last 2 years I'm in the United States, I have seen that one of the mayors are likely contestant in New York City, had extramarital affairs, and he could not, he had to withdraw because of this reason, if I recollect correctly. So there are more openness and there are more transparency, the way democracy functions in the United States, but it's not the case in India.
Mm-hmm. Well,
please bear in mind, in my judgment, the Modi is not a religious person.
Well, would you
using he's using religion to come into power.
Oh, so let's focus on that then. You're saying he's not a religious person, even though
he is not a religious person. It is the show of religion. It is the religion which is used to polarize and win the votes. It has never happened in the history of India that so many people voted on the pretext that the Muslims in India, who are exactly, who have all the same attributes like any Indian citizen. Genetically, the Indian Muslims are similar, physically, they speak different languages, their diversity is as diverse as Hindus. For example, the Muslim living in Kerala, they don't speak Hindi or Urdu. The Muslims staying in Bengal, they can't understand anything other than Bengali. So the Muslims are very diverse, and they are there all over India. But in spite of that, the BJP party was able to create a devil out of the Muslim community. They presented Muslims as a danger for the Indian community, including, for example, some of the BJP guys telling, okay, most all the terrorists in India are Muslims. They belong to that community, which is actually not correct. So the use of religion to win votes, it has happened glaringly right in front of us, in front of the whole world, and we can't do anything about it. Actually, you can't ask votes by taking religion in the name of religion. But if you create a communal riot, you already made that statement that during the elections or just before the elections, you create a communal riot and kill, in Muzaffarnagar about just a month before the elections or 2 months before the election, almost 100 Muslims were killed. And the reason behind that killing was one of the lieutenant of Modi himself was in UP for pre-electoral arrangements, and he has been instrumental in creating this riot. But the fact is, now the police and the judiciary don't think that there is a direct evidence of involvement. It is the same rule which was applied to Modi when 2002, more than 1,000 people, 1,000 Gujaratis were massacred in the streets and homes of that state. And then the chief minister of that state is not held responsible. So you could see how the institutions, democratic institutions, are manipulated in India.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but we're ending on a very disturbing note, because what you're telling us is that Modi is not so much a religious fundamentalist as that he is a cynical man who uses religion for political power and does so in ways that cost the lives of innocent people in politically manufactured riots. So that is not something that we can feel very comfortable about.
And that is something which I think politically President Obama and the American government must engage India, because India is a big economy. If America withdraws from India, it hurts people, including minorities, minority Christians, minority Muslims. So, but as a person, Mr. Modi should be held responsible for his previous misdeed, and then the international human rights groups and international democratic the institutions which promote democratic values should take up this position at the international level.
Well, Dr. Absalah Sharif, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Absalah Sharif, who is the Executive Director and Chief Scholar of the U.S.-India Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., where he's engaged in policy research that impacts both the U.S. and Indian governments. He has been a Chief Economist at the National Council of Applied Economic Research in New Delhi and was a member of the Ministry of Home Affairs in the Government of India and was advisor to the Indian Prime Minister from 2004 to 2006, reviewing the inclusive growth policies in the context of Muslims, India's largest minority. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.